And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your community-powered radio station, KBOO in Portland, Oregon, USA. For those of you listening online, kboo.fm. This morning, we're going to be looking at climate change. I have a couple of folks lined up here to talk about this, and we're doing a last-minute switch. We're actually going to do the reverse order of what I had originally intended, because, well, sometimes phone calls don't quite go through when you're supposed to. So first this morning, going to be speaking with Tom Athanasiou. He works and writes with Eco Equity, which is a organization down in the Bay Area that looks at a wide variety of issues related to climate change, both from a scientific and policy and justice perspective. Welcome to KBOO's Airwaves, Tom. And
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being accommodating schedule-wise.
Oh, no worries. You got to be flexible on Kyoto Day.
Yep. You got to be flexible every day. Okay, so 7+ years in the making, maybe 2 decades. Hard to tell, but here it is at last. The Kyoto Protocol entered into effect officially many hours ago. There were celebrations in Kyoto, Japan, and around the world, and we'll have a little bit of audio from that later on in the program. You have written a new article, which we hope is online today.
I really hope it's going to be online any minute now. It was supposed to be online yesterday on Foreign Policy and Focus, which your readers, your listeners should know about anyways. It's a very, very good online progressive think tank.
Yeah, I believe many people do know of it. We have writers with it on our airwaves periodically. So the article is called A Glass Half Full, The Kyoto Protocol and Beyond. And, you know, there's talk that, you know, okay, so Kyoto's done and it's being implemented. And it's a really important first step. And I would never deny that. But at the same time, I would also point out in the same breath that it's not even remotely close to what physically and scientifically needs to happen or biologically needs to happen to not necessarily stabilize the climate, because that's a big task, but at least slow radically the
Avoid climate catastrophe.
Yeah. So
what we're talking about now is what has to be done in order to avoid a catastrophe. We're going to have what the United Nations so, you know, genteelly calls dangerous climate change. There is no longer any way to avoid it. It's arguably already happening, particularly if, you know, you're living in the north, the northern part of Canada in a traditional lifestyle. It's already very dangerous to you. If you have been flooded out on an island somewhere or hit by a hurricane, but it's going to get really dangerous. And the question is whether or not we can avoid a catastrophe and what has to be done.
Well, and there's been no shortage of I guess even compared to a couple of years ago, could be now considered sort of extreme news related to what's considered to be reasonably likely regarding the global climate system in the next several decades to one century out.
Yes, the science has completely clarified in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, it's important to be really clear about that, particularly in the United States, where, you know, there's large numbers of full-time flax whose sole purpose in life is to confuse this issue. But, you know, the big milestone really, well, there's a couple of big milestones, but one of them was the Arctic assessment, which basically tells us a number of very terrifying things about what's going on at the North Pole. And, you know, people are talking about the melting Arctic as if it was the ozone hole of the climate issue, particularly in North America.
Yeah, and that's not an accurate metaphor at all.
No, I mean, the ozone hole in the sense that the ozone hole is what got people's attention. The scientists were warning about ozone depletion for quite some time, but it wasn't taken seriously until the ozone hole, they actually had photographs of the ozone hole. And the question is whether or not the actual melting Arctic will focus people's minds in the same way. But, if, you know, more broadly, the science has really, really changed, and the scientific community has, I don't know exactly how to describe what's happening to the scientific community, but if, you know, you talk about the big climate science summit that was just 2 weeks ago in Exeter, England, which, you know, was a government summit, there's really no question anymore about what's going to happen except questions at the margin. It's going to be very, very bad. And the question is how quickly we can arrange to have global greenhouse gas emissions peak. And, you know, what political, economic, social accommodation is going to be necessary in order for that to happen. And, of course, just one last thing, and I'll let you talk, mm-hmm. Andrew. This is why the so-called skeptics, you know, want to keep the debate on whether or not there's a problem, right? Because as long as they can keep the debate on this pseudo-debate about whether or not there's a really serious problem here, that means we never have the real debate, which is what are the political and economic implications of the situation? What are we going to do about it? That's the real debate.
Well, it's political and economical here, you know, in the U.S., for example. In other places, particularly kind of low-lying countries, island states, it's cultural, and the use of the word genocide has been made repeatedly over many, many years, I guess the past decade or so, regarding the continued actions of developed country inhabitants regarding their emission of carbon. So the issues are not the same everywhere. And, you know, for people who think that, well, you know, God, it's going to be so difficult to, you know, re-engineer society or my life or how am I going to get places, you know, chances are you're going to be able to stay where you live, and not everybody will have that luxury in the future. Another sort of, I guess it's kind of a minor aspect, but in the Arctic, Inuit peoples are finding critters and plants and things that they don't know what it is. They've never, ever seen it. They don't have words to explain what it is that they are viewing, and so there's other cultural and social stresses that, you know, it might seem like a minor thing compared to, you know, maybe having to, like, wait for the bus in the cold or something like that. But, you know, just so people are aware that there's a wide range of possible impacts depending on where it is you live. And things that are viewed by folks in the U.S. as, you know, inconvenient or a hassle, really in kind of a larger scheme of things, when you talking about, say, the disappearance of a culture or the inability to live on the land that your people used to live on for thousands and thousands of years, really isn't that big a deal.
Right. I mean, as Tom Paine put it, in Common Sense, it is the good fortune of the few to live far from the scene of sorrow. You know, we in the rich world are largely responsible for this problem. And we are largely insulated from what will be its worst impacts. And that is a very, very serious issue, which is debated constantly in the climate negotiations. I mean, the question is, you know, if you read the Kyoto press coverage today, you know, the basic sense of it is that, you know, even though the Bush administration has done everything in its power to destroy the climate negotiations process, Kyoto has finally gone into effect. It's a worthy first step. What happens next? And, of course, what happens next it means what are the terms by which the rich world participates in a climate transition that is going to require very, very radical changes in the industrial structure, and what are the terms by which the developing world participates in that climate transition? And you know, the developing world is, you know, it's important to not be overly abstract about this. That this includes the Bangladeshi peasants who are going to get flooded out, and it also includes the Saudi royal family, right? So one of the things that the climate issue is forcing is that we be more particular and more precise about what we mean. It's the poor and the vulnerable everywhere who are going to be impacted by climate change and also by the economic and social dislocation attendant to climate change. And it's the rich and the powerful everywhere who will be able to insulate themselves from it. And, you know, this is actually commonly discussed in the negotiations. You know, what's going to be the deal? How is it going to work?
Now, if I remember correctly, you were down at the Conference of the Parties 10 in Buenos Aires, Argentina, back in November, correct?
That is correct. I've been to the last five COPs.
Okay. And we'll just call them COP for future reference. You write, COP 10 was a so-called sleepy COP. There was not a lot of visible action, but the lull itself was the real story, and it was fraught with meaning. Can you describe a little bit about your view of how the Bush administration is, well, we're not part of the Kyoto Protocol. That's more than clear. But it appears as though the U.S. doesn't really want to be part of anything that's going to force it. You know, the U.S. and specifically the Bush administration is really, really against the idea of binding rules, at least for itself. Can you tell us a little bit about how the Bush administration is impacting the process of the rest of the world wanting to begin looking beyond Kyoto?
Well, I mean, it's hard to exaggerate how destructive our government is being in, you know, in the UN climate negotiations. You know, we are parties to the UN Framework Convention, which was signed at the Earth Summit way back in 1992. And that was a that treaty was signed by, you know, by the United States under George the First, the Bush the First, and but when Bush the Second pulled us out of the Kyoto process in 2001, the American diplomats that were representing the Bush administration in Bonn at that time, you know, went out of their way to say, you know, we're not going to be obstructionist. You know, we're not going to participate in the Kyoto Protocol, but we're not going to get in the way of anybody else who tries to make this thing work. Mm. Well, nothing has been further from the truth. I mean, the best way to imagine the Buenos Aires negotiations is perhaps, you know, a rainy day and a slate mountainside, and the Europeans and some honest people from the developing world trying to climb this wall and not fall. And at the bottom of the cliff, you have the United States and the Saudis throwing rocks at them. I mean, everything that they could possibly do procedurally and in terms of backroom deals to try to sabotage the negotiations, to just basically grind them to a halt, to represent them as being irrelevant, to say the United States will never participate in the future, so that if you guys try to get out in front of what we're willing to do, it's just going to be to your economic disadvantage. There were even, in Buenos Aires, there were even, you know, right-wing groups, who knows who they were, AstroTurf public relations firms that were counterfeiting NGO and activist literature and ridiculing the groups that, you know, ridiculing people like the Inuit and peasants that were going to have their water supply in danger, and say that they were just taking money from Greenpeace to pretend that they were victims of climate change. It was just the same story that we're all so used to in the United States with this sort of Karl Rovian scumdoggery. It was really a pretty bad scene, and you know, so things ground to a halt, almost to a halt. But you know, everybody knows it's gonna hold together because There's no choice but to hold the process together. And the Framework Convention gives the United Nations a way to hold the process together, even if the United States is extremely destructive. The question is when there's going to be a breakthrough in the negotiations that allows something appropriate to the crisis to actually be done. And, you know, a lot of that depends on what happens in this country. But, you know, in the worst case scenario where the Bush administration was to, you know, auger in a period of perpetual right-wing governance, the rest of the world would have to find a way of going on without the United States. And that actually raises questions of, like, tariff barriers against American corporations. And because there would have to be a way of protecting the rest of the world from this, you know, this great huge Northern American free riding economy that just refused to limit its carbon emissions. So it's all sorts of things on the table. Of course, we're all hoping that that doesn't happen, right? We're all hoping that once the mechanisms instantiated by Kyoto go into effect. I mean, even the business class is gonna want some sort of predictability. I mean, you have California, for Christ's sake, under the governor down here who is trying to, you know, who has announced that he's going to protect the California greenhouse initiatives from the Bush administration in court. So these people are fairly isolated, but they're extremely powerful, and so far they've managed to make themselves into a wrench in the gears. But, you know, I mean, the real problem here is isolating the fossil cartel, which is, you know, the Saudis, the oil sector, much of the old manufacturing sector, the Bush administration, Texas, you know, that whole fossil fortress cartel. They have a lock on the international political economic scene, and it's a very, very, very dangerous lock. The other thing is that, you know, the science, with the science turning the way it is turning, the stakes are visibly becoming very, very high. So you have the Financial Times, for example, no progressive or left broadsheet campaigning for some sort of more rational approach. So, I mean, that's the good news. The good news is that the Bush administration is swimming against the tide of history and cannot possibly hold the United States in this position, so that when the dam bursts, you know, a lot of action is going to occur. The bad news is that who knows how long they're going to be in power, and who knows when we as a society are going to be willing to ask the tough questions about what's going to have to happen in order to reduce global emissions.
Well, and additionally, we all have to remember that the climate does not operate according to what we want as such. We can impact it. We are impacting it. But, you know, it's doing its own thing in response to our impacts on it. And, you know, the climate sort of doesn't care if we're here or not. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. We're speaking with Tom Athanasiou. He works with Eco Equity, and you can find out more about them online at www.ecoequity.org. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links to them, their writings, and a whole bunch of other stuff related to climate change and the adoption or the enactment of the Kyoto Protocol earlier today. In the last few minutes here, Tom, let's talk about, well, continue to talk about Beyond Kyoto. Earlier this year, a British official talked about the idea of reorienting global climate talks to something that would be more palatable to the United States to get them included. With about a quarter of the world's CO2 emissions, the U.S. realistically needs to be involved in whatever steps are taken to mitigate catastrophic climate change. The same is true, however, of India, Brazil, and China, and possibly a few other countries. But those are the three largest countries with the greatest potential impact in the future. China is going to outstrip U.S. CO2 emissions at current rates sometime. I think it's in the late 2020s or early 2030s. They're building coal plants like crazy. And, all this in the context of it's not India, Brazil, and China that are responsible for the current problem. That's primarily inhabitants of the U.S. However, you can't give these huge economies with potentials for tremendous CO2 emissions a free pass for, you know, decades or centuries or whatever to build up their economies, because if we reduce emissions here and that's offset by emissions elsewhere, it doesn't matter globally where the emissions come from. It's the fact that they continue to increase.
That's correct.
So what do you see as a way to involve the U.S., India, and China? No easy task because of both climate and other global talks ongoing.
Well, I think that's really is the question. And a couple of things you have to remember. One, we used up all the atmospheric space. The reason why Chinese emissions are a problem is because the world is already over budget, and we did that, and we got rich doing that, and now we're rich, right? And everybody else wants to live like us. Another thing is that you have to make, if you're talking about politics and you're talking about justice, you have to make comparisons not in terms of Chinese emissions versus American emissions, but in terms of per capita emissions. And even though the Chinese emissions will, at some point in the future, a couple of decades down the road, equal American emissions at current trends, which will change, their per capita emissions will still be very, very much lower than ours. I mean, our per capita emissions are the second highest in the world, second only to Canada, by the way. And the question is, what would be fair to countries in the developing world? And the project, that's the project that is at the center of eco-equity. And our answer is, believe it or not, that the rich world there's got to be some sort of deal by which the rich world pays for the decarbonization of the economies in the developing world. We simply don't see an alternative which is going to lead to decarbonization fast enough to avoid climate catastrophe. I mean, I would encourage your listeners to go to ecoequity.org and read the article "Honesty About Dangerous Climate Change," or to look at the glass half full piece, which will be posted on our website soon, and to follow some of the links to the Exeter conference. Global emissions have to peak in about 15 years, and that's counting the emissions of China, Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, India, and the rest of the developing world. And, so the question of what would be fair to the United States, which is the question that the Bush administration loves to talk about, well, yes, that's a real question. But there's another question: what would be fair to India? What would be fair to China? And we believe that we are at a historical juncture now in which the question of fairness is absolutely paramount, and that we have to think about it in very clear terms. The fact of the matter is the Chinese, the Indonesians, the Brazilians, the South Africans are not going to decarbonize their economies rapidly enough to avoid climate catastrophe unless it's in the context of a global accord in which those countries which have already gotten rich in part by exploiting the carbon commons as if it had no limit pay the, help to defray the costs of decarbonization in the developing world. There simply is no alternative. So the question is really a question of global economic justice. And it's obviously closely allied to questions that are paramount in the United States, which is how to talk about domestic economic justice, which is the key to breaking the lock of the Republicans in this country anyways. And, you know, so, you know, it's a funny thing. You know, the question of universal health care in the United States is an economic justice question. You know, people in the environmental justice movement talk about just transitions. The problem that's facing the world now is how to have a just transition in the global energy sector, which is, you know, the biggest, most concentrated, most powerful sector of the existing economy. And it's a huge historical question, and it is not, absolutely not going to go away. The ecosystem is not going to let this leave the front page for long.
And that doesn't even take into consideration the issue related to intergenerational aspects of climate change. This is not something that's around now and, you know, 2100 is going to come around and, you know, things will be better. It's going to take centuries, many centuries, to reverse this, if that is in fact possible.
Right. I mean, the big question from the point of view of centuries is, can we prevent the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, and can we prevent the complete melting of the Greenland ice? Because between the two of those, we're talking about something like 14 meters of sea level increase. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that, what that means is that since the bulk of human settlements are on coasts, that it means that the bulk of human settlements would be inundated by the rising waters. Now, you tell me whether you think that our society is stable enough and cooperative enough to manage the manage the social changes that would follow from a rising of the waters, you know, in a graceful and peaceful fashion.
Right. Well, the neither the CIA nor the Pentagon think that's possible, and that's why they're both really concerned, but they don't talk much about it. Tom, I appreciate you joining us this morning, and again, being flexible on the last-minute flip-flop here. We're actually going to do the rest of the program here on the science of climate change, including stuff that happened at Exeter a couple of weeks ago. We're going to have someone who was there join us in a little bit. Tom Athanasiou works with EcoEquity. He is the co-director there, and you can find out more about them online at www.ecoequity.org. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm also has links to them and many other articles about what we've been talking about. So thanks very much for joining us this morning, Tom.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.